Software Engineering Radio Episode 20, Interview with Michael Stahl. Welcome, Michael, to Software Engineering Radio. Why don't you introduce yourself and explain to the listeners what you do in real life?
Sure. Hello, Markus. Nice to hear you. So basically, my background is I started 1991 basically at Siemens Corporate Technology. And I worked at the beginning in the area of software architecture and object orientation. So these were my main focus on the software corporate technology department of Siemens. I then became member of the OMG. So that was the first start for me to deal more and think more about middleware. And I also started almost the same time to work on patterns with Frank Buschmann. Mm-hmm. So, then I started to switch from the software architecture department to the department which was dealing with distributed and parallel systems, and became head of the distributed systems team. And in the same time, Frank and me were cooperating on the first book on pattern-oriented software architecture.
Rather famous POSA book.
Yes, absolutely. And then we also, after Frank, joined my new department, which then became the software architecture department again. We worked on a POSA 2 book. And I'm currently lead of a team focusing on distributed systems, middleware, software architecture. So that's basically my research focus. And I'm also currently coordinating a research program at Siemens, which is dealing with software product lines and platforms for distributed systems. So basically, middleware and software architecture and patterns have been my main central research working areas at Siemens.
You say research. Are you like are you heading a department? Are you a researcher? Are you a Siemens internal consultant? So what's your work schedule like?
So I have basically two hats on. My first hat is I'm lead of a team of 12 people who are working in research projects, but mainly in customer projects. So where we are doing some architecture consulting, architecture reviews, helping customers to get the systems right, also helping them to develop the systems, basically. But we also have another one-third of our time spending for, let's say, research things like model-driven software development, aspect orientation, service mm-hmm. orientation, mm-hmm. all of the things which are relevant for Siemens.
Actually, these will be interesting topics to talk about later, AO and model-driven and service-oriented architecture and stuff. So I didn't know that you were on the OMG. What did you do there?
I was member of the OMG on behalf of Siemens. So basically, I was more, but I must make sure I'm well. I was more observing things and not so standardizing or defining things. So basically, Siemens was interested in observing what will happen there. Mm-hmm. So that was the time when Korba came in the focus of the community. So that's basically was my main interest in the object management group that time.
Okay, so maybe let's start talking about middleware a little bit. Most people probably know what middleware is, more or less, but do you want to give us some kind of a definition, or what's the typical cases where middleware is used? We already had this episode in remoting patterns where we talked a bit about middleware, but we didn't provide a general definition and we didn't outline the various kinds of middleware, so maybe that's something you could do now.
Sure. So what is middleware? The problem with this question is that there are probably only wrong answers, but I will try. The most important thing, or the most naive answer, is basically that middleware is anything between the operating system and the application layer. And that's basically where the name comes from. Middleware means sitting in the middle between the application and the operating system. And basically, middleware is providing, from my viewpoint, is platform that is providing services to the applications in a system agnostic way. The problem with this definition, of course, is that this is almost true for everything, like directory services, databases, and so
libraries.
On. Everything, libraries, yes, you're right. Dynamic linked libraries, all kinds of libraries.
Yeah.
So basically, most experts that I know think that middleware is mainly communication middleware. So basically, it's something which helps you to communicate among different applications. So it's basically a kind of transparency layer, maybe consisting of, let's say, a stack of adapters that are mediating between system infrastructure and applications in order to allow applications to communicate with each other. The problem is that most people think that CORBA.com, Windows Communication Framework, or Java RMI, that's basically middleware, and that's the only possible middleware solutions. And they really think, or I have met many people who really think that remoting middleware is everything about middleware, but that's not true. So it's more than remoting.
So other paradigms are like messaging and these kinds of things, but that's also a communication middleware. Would you say that things like component containers, such as J2E, EJBs, or COM+, would you also call this middleware, or is this like transaction middleware or component middleware or communication middleware? Do you distinguish between those?
I distinguish between different things. From my viewpoint, there's remoting middleware, which is the basic layer in order to communicate using a kind of invocation-based paradigm. Mm-hmm. Then I see something like messaging middleware, MQ series, MSMQ, and so on. Then eventing middleware, transaction monitors, for instance, are different kinds of middleware solutions. And even service orientation, for instance, is also kind of middleware. It's maybe a special case of messaging, but it's also a special kind of meta middleware in order to interoperate between different other middlewares.
Yeah.
Grid computing. So basically, there are a lot of different kinds of middleware systems, but I think the mainstream systems are basically messaging and remoting.
If people have to decide which communication paradigm to use, do you have any like best practices there? It's typically clear if I need a component middleware or a transaction monitor, then I have to use, I don't know, EJB or COM+. But how do I decide whether to use things like CORBA or messaging middleware on the other side?
I think one of the most important issues here is if you have something like long-term transactions or things where you don't need an immediate answer, for instance, or things where you have where you're more focusing on data and not on services which are executed on a remote node, are more or better suitable in order to use messaging middleware. There are even some things which you cannot definitely do with remoting middleware. For instance, if you think about, I'm sending you a request and I need multiple replies. For instance, I'm getting multiple fragments of the same video stream. So that's mm-hmm. basically something which you can definitely not do with remoting middleware.
Right, so but that would be streaming and not messaging either. So that's maybe
sure.
a third kind of middleware.
Yeah, absolutely. So audio video streaming is basically a complete other kind of middleware, and I don't see any big standards out there in the community which we can use here at the moment, at least.
Mm-hmm. Some people say that messaging is better because it decouples systems, and I always think that's, I mean, technically it's true. So if I send a message and the other side isn't available, then the message can be buffered and, you know, you can dispatch it later and I get the reply later. But in many systems, that, you know, if I need the reply, that then that's technically decoupled, but the process that I want to run needs the reply, so that doesn't really help me. So can you give us two or three examples where messaging middleware is really like the solution and remoting doesn't work?
Sure. For instance, consider you have a network management system consisting of multiple devices and you want to send around, let's say, error notifications or other things from all of these different devices which are managed by the network management system. So basically, I think that's something where you can't really work with remoting middleware, because if you would use remoting middleware, that would mean that if you have something like an agent, you would have to notify everyone about every event which is appearing in your system. So basically, an example for this was Microsoft tried in COM+ to have something like tight coupled events. So basically, that meant if you want to send an event to, let's say, 100 subscribers, they definitely used a remoting middleware approach. So they had to send each message to each of the subscribers, which does not rip. So that's a basic example where you have some lot of subscribers, lot of recipients of your messages. Another example is, for instance, if you send something like a purchase order to a order system or something like this, which is which maybe take a long time to be processed, for instance, let's 1 hour, then you would not try to make this a remoting approach, because then you would have to deal with blocking synchronicity and asynchronicity and all of these things, which make your life really very complicated if you are using remoting middleware for that kind of purpose.
When we talk about middleware, I think we obviously have to talk about web services too. So most people have a very distinct opinion with regards to web services. Like, many people like it and see it like that's the solution for all of our problems. Other people hate it because they say it's the same stuff as always, just with all those XML angled brackets. So what's your opinion on web services? Did you use them? Are they used at Siemens?
Yes, sure. We basically made a little conference at Siemens last year where we looked at what people are doing at Siemens with all of these service-oriented architecture stuff. And basically, I got two opinions on that. My first opinion is, if you only look at web services, then this might be something which is interesting for integrating different kinds of systems on an enterprise level. And it won't work for things like building real-time or embedded systems.
Obviously.
So basically, it's, for me, it's a kind of meta middleware. And I think the primary value of web services is the paradigm which is behind web services, which I call service-oriented architecture. So from my viewpoint, SOA is not something which is a one-to-one relationship with web services. It's more something like a paradigm which can be also used with other technologies, like messaging middleware, for instance.
Right. Okay, so we'll talk about service-oriented architecture in a minute. Just want to go back to web services very briefly. So there are two camps in the web services world. One is basically this REST thing, where people say just use HTTP GET and put in all that stuff with as simple as possible XML schemas to transport data. And then there is the standards movement, which, you know, these WSIXY*, whatever. Do you see an adoption of all those WS standards, or are people more pragmatic in saying that, you know, we just use HTTP and send over the network, maybe using SOAP, but otherwise just a little bit WSTL? What do you see? What's the adoption rate of all those WSI standards?
A little bit, it reminds me of what happened to CORBA. When you remember CORBA, it started with a very small and very simple communication broker. And then after a while, people recognized that you need security services and other services in order to make really big enterprise-based applications. And exactly the same thing is now happening with web services. It started very simple. So basically, SOAP originally stood for a simple object access protocol. And if you remember, it isn't simple, it's not object-oriented, and it's not based on access. So basically, it's just renamed SOAP now. Basically,
right, I think that's really funny that people redefine an abbreviation to not mean the thing anymore for which it was originally defined. So just, you know, remove the meaning of the term.
Absolutely. And if you look at all of these standards, it was the same for CORBA. You got a bunch, 12 or 13 CORBA services. And if you look at the real CORBA implementations, then even now, 10 years later, you only will see 3 or 4 different CORBA services which are really delivered with each of the CORBA products. And I think the same thing will happen with web services. I don't think that anyone is really able to have 20 or 30 WS services available with his web service toolkits. And I think the worst thing about it is that there are even conflicting standards. People are not unified in their opinion about all of these different WS standards. There are different standards for coordination and for other things, for conversation. And I'm really skeptical. So basically, I think you should really take it pragmatic. Take what is available within IBM, Microsoft, BA, whatever you're using for it, and try to come up with a solution that is really able to use all of the things which are available, and don't wait for having 30, 40, or whatever number of web service standards which you need, because that basically will never happen.
So going back to Corba, I think the services that have been deployed were, I think, like notification, transactions, security, and of course naming and trading. So maybe that's a sign what's going to prevail in the web services world.
And that's really interesting because as SOAP started, as the web service paradigm and evolution started, everyone told me that SOAP and SOA and web services would be very simple, very usable, and now it really has the same kind of complexity or is starting to have the same kind of complexity as all of the other Corba and DCOM and other middleware solutions.
Actually, I like your calling web services a kind of meta middleware, a middleware to integrate various system partitions which use other middlewares internally. From my point of view, that's also the most sensible use of using web services, because usually there, the overhead that you get from all those XML stuff doesn't really matter.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about SOA. Same old architecture, as some people say. Or what was the other thing was a stupid, overhyped acronym. But of course, it stands for service-oriented architecture. So what's from your point of view? You already said that's basically an architectural metaphor or a blueprint. So what are the most important characteristics of an SOA from your point of view?
So basically, the first important thing is that everything is really using explicit interfaces. So in contrast to Corba, for instance, or COM, where you're really directly addressing a component, you only see interfaces. So you don't make yourself dependent on implementations. And that's basically the first thing. Explicit interfaces are really important here. I think the second thing is that, for instance, everything is really loosely coupled. There's a good book around which is called Loose Coupling by Dake, I guess. And that's a very interesting book because it really deals with all of these loose coupling things like late binding and using registries in order to find the services. Don't think that there are fixed connections between the client and the service. So basically all of these things are really important in this area. So it's basically interfaces and, of course, also the contracts. Every interface is defined by a contract, is expressed by a contract, which basically tells you what is the service really providing to you in terms of the services and where is it really located. And I think in the future there will be additional things in the contract, like semantic things. For instance, what exactly is the ontology of the services provided by your service interface? Or what kind of quality of service will be provided? I guess that's something which will happen in the future.
Yeah, people talk about service level agreements there. And one of my current customers, which I probably shouldn't name here, also currently works on establishing an SOA. And it's really funny because I've worked a lot in the component-based development area, and I can use all my meta models that I use for component-based development. I can reuse them in SOA. Where do you see the connection between component-based development, where you also have explicitly defined interfaces, where you explicitly deploy things, where you configure components? Where do you see the relationship between CBD and SOA?
From my viewpoint, component-based development is more focusing on remoting. Basically, if you look at the component middleware applications, which you will see now, most of them are really basing on remoting middleware. So calling the method, in this case is executed in a component, and so on. All of these things are more remoting oriented. And I think service orientation, SOAP especially, is more on the messaging paradigm. So you're sending a message to an object. So basically, it's more the old style of object orientation, which came in by Smalltalk, for instance. So I think that's one of the big differences between regular component-based development and service orientation. But of course, this also depends on what kind of definition you have when you're speaking about component-based development.
The point from my point of view in component-based development is that you have clearly defined building blocks which define what they provide and which also define which interface they require, so you can do some decent dependency management.
Sure.
And yeah.
Sorry, only one point which I forgot is that service orientation is nothing else than a continuous evolution of object orientation and component-based development. So I think it comes to no surprise that service orientation is really an addition or an extension of component-based development.
Right. That's what I think too. And it's basically lessons learned from component-based development, where things were sometimes too tightly coupled and stuff. So now you do some more, you know, like more messaging style or document-centric instead of having these tightly coupled interfaces. But you know, if you talk with managers, you hear all this business-driven and process-integrated and policy-based. It's really hard to not lose your temper.
Yeah, it's a new hype, and that's basically the danger, because people start to think of the hype as it would be a real working technology which would solve all of your problems, and that's basically not the case.
Right. Another thing that I'd briefly like to visit is... you talked about your research projects at Siemens, and you mentioned aspect-oriented and model-driven development. Do you see a specific relationship between aspect orientation and middleware in general, or between model-driven development and SOA? So any synergies that are particularly interesting?
Sure, because as I said before, I'm coordinating a research program which is dealing with platform and product line development and for distributed systems. And we have all of these projects in there. For instance, the AOSD project and the model-driven project and the service orientation project, and all of them are trying to find what are their synergies. And for instance, one of the synergies that we came up with was in a model-driven area, for instance, if you are dealing with domain-specific languages, for instance, then what you get if you're using people as an example in the service orientation, then if you want to express things like workflows or so, that's basically a domain-specific language. And you can really use tools in order to take that domain-specific language in order to generate something like a service-oriented application. So I think there are some really interesting things which you can do using model-driven software development techniques in order to build service-oriented architectures. Mm-hmm. And I think a similar issue for aspect orientation, if you look at, let's say, JBoss, AOP, and all of these things, interceptor-based frameworks, for instance, like Spring, I think the same thing will really happen if you use service orientation. So we have built internally an open source framework for service orientation, which is called FAST. So it's basically something like a package which tries to integrate things like web service toolkits and XML-based databases and so on. And in order to make the life easier for the operator, we have come up with something which is called an interceptor AOP framework, so that the operator is basically able to intercept all incoming web service requests and do something else with it, using his own kind of scripting language, for instance. So basically, AOP might, for instance, be helpful in service orientation to add functionality for an operator, or even add the same thing like what Spring is doing, for instance, or JBoss AOP is doing, add some functionality out of the band functionality into your processing of the service-oriented system.
So one could maybe say that AO can be used to make the middleware configurable to add, as you said, out-of-band services or functionality. And model-driven development maybe helps to keep control of the overall system, to describe components, services, so that you can, you know, understand and track what's happening, because you don't lose the overview.
Yes, I think one of the examples, if you speak about software service-oriented architecture, then basically most people think about business processes. And if you look at business processes, one thing, for instance, cross-cutting concerns are business rules. For instance, if you have business rules which are impacting different areas of your applications, then basically a business rule engine I would also consider as a kind of aspect-oriented approach. So basically aspect orientation would also be helpful in order to do something like integrating business rules, all of these things. So basically that's what I think would be an appropriate relationship and synergy between service orientation and aspect orientation.
So that you would basically say you define the business rules once, and then you use AO-like approaches to make sure they're enforced on the server and maybe even on the client, some kind of validations, and maybe also maybe in the middleware to enforce some quality of service things.
Sure. And I think the nice thing would be, because service orientation tries to be implementation agnostic. So if you would come up with, let's say, method interceptor interfaces that would be independent of, let's say, .NET or Java 2E or whatever technology you're using, then you could even build interceptors or aspects independently of the technology in which you are using these aspects. So basically, you could really decouple the aspects and their implementation from the actual implementation of this rest of the system, for instance.
Since you mentioned J2E and .NET, a couple of years ago, I think I once stood in for you and did a talk that compared .NET and J2E. I think that was on an ACCU conference in 2002, maybe. So looking back, what's your perspective now? How have the two platforms developed? Where do you think which of the two platforms is better suited for particular things? Like, for example, using J2E for enterprise system and .NET for clients. Do you have any opinion there? Can you compare the two platforms briefly and say where they have their strengths?
I think it's really difficult to compare them because there are so many things around, and basically right. There's so many layers, because if you compare .NET with Java, you can compare different things like comparing the virtual machines, comparing the libraries, comparing the IDEs. But basically, from my viewpoint, if you only look at the middleware stuff, then I think there are a lot of different things happening there. For instance, in the .NET world, if you look at the Windows Communication Foundation, you have something which I would call an enterprise service bus. It's basically...
Can you briefly explain what WCF stands, what it is?
So it's the Windows Communication Foundation, originally named Indigo, and it's basically something which extends .NET remoting. It's an integration of .NET remoting, MSMQ, web services, and basically it provides something like a container-based framework where you can really get SOAP-based messages, but independent of the underlying transport protocol, where you can consume these messages and on a kind of remoting-based paradigm send messages around, invoke other services on other nodes, and use different kinds of cross-cutting concerns like security, which are already in the container. So basically, it's a really highly configurable, open implementation, something which I really would call an enterprise service bus implementation, where everything can be exchanged, everything is configurable, you can add your own protocols. So it's really something which strongly resembles .NET remoting, but it's a much more flexible and configurable approach.
So the cynic in me would say it's like EJB with web services on top.
Not really, because I think there are differences between Windows Communication Foundation and EJB. EJB basically is more a component-based framework where with different kinds of components, session components, entity components. So basically, the Windows Communication Foundation framework is not... caring about persistence, for instance, which is basically a very important thing, at least from my viewpoint, in the AGP stuff. So basically, yeah. I think there are a lot of differences, and I think the AGP component containers are more used in order to build enterprise-based transaction-oriented systems, while the Windows Communication Foundation is more like Corva. It's more remoting service-based communication right. platform and not a full-blown container framework.
Okay, so you say .NET is hard to compare with J2E because it's so it has many different layers, but you say that WCF is something that's interesting, that's probably going to be important. So is that what you're saying, among
Absolutely.
Other things?
You can compare them, but because basically you can build enterprise systems either using Java 2E or Microsoft.NET, but I see currently more people using Java 2E for building enterprise systems than they would use .NET, for instance. So basically, yeah, that might change, and I think that will change, but currently Java 2E seems to be more suitable for building enterprise systems than .NET. And that's basically the reason why Microsoft is coming up with these new WCF framework.
Right. That was my impression, too. When .NET was new, I remember being at probably the OOP conference in Munich, and there was this case study talk by one of the German insurance companies showing their .NET project. But, I mean, I'm more of a Java guy, but I didn't see many really big enterprise projects adopting .NET. There is really more stuff going on in the J2E world.
Absolutely. But as I said before, that might definitely change because I think Java 2E and Java especially have a very long advantage because they are really old now, old in the positive sense. So basically they are mature technologies, and I think .NET is something which is rapidly developing, moving forward, and also has some strengths which I see more in the on the .NET side than on the Java side, for instance. So basically it's better integrated, it's better using XML stuff, for instance. It's a much better implementation of web services. So if you look at Java, you get a lot of toolkits with a lot of different APIs. So basically it's more uniform. So I think there are a lot of advantages using .NET, but for the enterprise system world, I really consider HEB, Spring, and all of these things as much better and much more advanced and much more mature now.
Have you looked at SCA, the Service Component Architecture?
A little bit. I am in contact with an IBM fellow, with Don Ferguson, and he was here and visited us at Siemens and showed us something about the SCA. So it's a really interesting approach, and I think that's something which is definitely worth waiting for and something which should have a big influence in the future.
Right, that's my impression too, and also it looks not completely similar, but somewhat alike Windows Communication Foundation. It also has this view of a system. It has a more message-oriented metaphor, so it's maybe better to compare WCF with SCA than comparing J2E with .NET or
If
something.
you look at the IBM WebSphere product family, for instance, and if you look at the development of WebSphere, I think that basically WebSphere and SCA, for instance, and in WCF, the Windows Communication Foundation, are moving exactly in the same direction. So basically, I would call them integrative middleware solutions, where you don't have to plug in all of the different units from yourself. You have to integrate everything yourself, but where you get really big support in building components, integrating them independent of the transport protocol used or the different kinds of services you need. So basically, they are really giving you big and much advanced handling of all of these distribution development stuff.
I'd like to get to another topic. We talked. You mentioned before that obviously you're one of the co-authors of POSA 1 and 2, so you're quite involved with patterns. So how do you think the patterns community today? How did you see the influence of your, especially of the POSA 1 patterns? I think they are quite fundamental, the architectural patterns in there. POSA 2 is quite specialized for some people, interesting, but it's not that broad, I think. So how do you see the adoption of patterns in software architecture?
When I'm in any of the Siemens projects, then I think in compared to 5, 6 years ago, when the first books came out, for instance, then people are really thinking with patterns. So I don't have to explain to developers anymore what a pattern is and that a pattern might be variable. I don't have to explain a thing to managers. So I think at least in the projects where I am involved, patterns are used and there is no resistance, and people really think that's something which we should use. It's
Probably like some oh God, Michael Stahl is coming. Let's quickly read the book and learn all those pattern names.
absolutely not. It's
That's
not.
joking.
5 or 6 years ago, I remember I was with Erich Gamma at a conference, and one of the attendees asked a question to Erich and asked him, yes, I have built an application and I've used all of your Gov patterns. And Erich was really puzzled and was really enjoying that kind of question. And so basically, that's not something which is really happening now. So basically, people think that or see that patterns are a very important tool. It's one of many tools. You also have to use UML or modeling stuff and all of these things, but patterns are a really useful tool in order to really fastly get the expertise of other people into your system without steadily reinventing the wheel. So basically, it's something which really works. And I think if you look at how many people are using the Gang of Four patterns, for instance, and even the POSA patterns, I think are very widespread now. I think people really think about the patterns and really believe that patterns are the real thing, the good thing to do. And I don't think that there are many people around currently that don't consider patterns as a valuable tool.
Yeah, I would also say patterns are part of the mainstream now, and one sign that shows that is that books with a title blah, 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 blah patterns don't sell anymore as good as they did once. Maybe POSAR books, I don't know, it's probably different. They probably still say 50,000 a year. But in general, the term pattern is not something that's hyped anymore, which is good because now it's part of the mainstream.
Well, now you have the books with the SUA in the title.
Right. Okay. So let's wait until it's mainstream.
I think the only thing which is important about patterns, I think there are not many people know that there are several pattern conferences, the BLOP, EuroBLOP, and other conferences.
And we talked about that in our earlier episode, but it's again worth repeating, obviously.
And another thing which is really astonishing, that people are trying to, that there are not many things happening in the community in terms of new books coming out. I would have expected more books on fundamental patterns like the POSAR 1 or GOF patterns, mm-hmm. for instance, and I'm really surprised that nothing in this area is happening, basically. So
yeah, there are a lot of domain-specific patterns, like security patterns, model-driven stuff, or domain-driven patterns, and SOA patterns already, AJAX patterns. So I think the literature form of patterns is still used, but the fundamental stuff, yeah, you're right, there's not too much going on there.
I think when this pattern community started, there was much more expectations here. So people really thought that after 5-10 years, there would be really big encyclopedias with full of patterns. Everyone would know all of these patterns. There would not only be over 20 GOF patterns, but there would be really a lot of different patterns which you could use, different kinds of search strategies in order to find the right patterns for your projects. And all of these things didn't happen. But on the other side, I think the hype is over and people are really using patterns and don't complaining about using patterns. They are really in their concrete projects using them, and that's the good sign.
Yeah, actually, isn't Grady Booch working on this really, really, really big architecture thingy, which also collects all existing patterns? I think he has already collected like 200 or something. Do you know more details about
that? I don't know more details. I only saw some messages on his webpage and where he spoke about his book project, and that's the only source of information I have. But I hope it will really come out and not like the Donald Knuth volume 4.
Yes. Yeah, I think we have to get Grady Booch on the show so he can talk about it. Maybe let's try to get him.
That would be definitely an interesting interview.
Okay, so one last thing I'd like to ask you is talking about software reuse, specifically since you mentioned your involvement in software product lines before. Many new paradigms have been invented in order to facilitate reuse. Object orientation, component-based development, and probably SOA is probably also about reusing services over the enterprise. So do you think reusing software building blocks works well, or do you think that reusing knowledge, for example, as in the form of patterns, works better? What do you think, what is working better in practice?
My personal opinion is that reusing knowledge is much more pragmatic. I can remember a few years ago when all of these component hype was around, then people started to build all of these reuse repositories. And a former colleague of mine asked me, oh, you're building a repository, but you don't have any reusable components. Does that really make sense? Basically, the problem is, for instance, if you look at the enterprise world or at specific domains, then there will be no market in building up components or services for a very limited number of users. So basically, I think that does not work, definitely. What really works is reusing expertise from other people, because basically experienced developers and architects who are involved in different projects can collect a big number of different knowledge of expertise, and this could be made reusable using patterns. And I think that's something which is really working, because it's not something which you must use as it is, as it would be in the case of a component. You can just use an idea, and the idea can be adapted to your own needs. So you don't have to either use the component or use nothing. So it's more, if you're using a pattern, you can adapt it to your own needs, and that's much more pragmatic from my viewpoint. So basically, my experience in all of the projects I ever were, there was the only component which was all the time reused, which was called Crit. So it was basically this GUI grid, which you could use in all of these Microsoft projects, but all of the other components were really difficult. And I was in a big project where different business units had to agree what a patient, for instance, is or what a customer is. And that even that did not work. So basically, I don't believe in all of these reusability of component stuff.
That's really interesting, because if you look at the SOAR discussions, it's the same thing again. You have this one service that you know provides patient data, but again, people have to agree enterprise-wide now on what patient is or what the patient data is.
Absolutely.
So running in the same problem again.
If you have a standardized kind of service interface where everyone has to abide to, then this would definitely work. But I don't think this is something which really works for all kinds of problems. And exactly, if you look at what people are using web services for now, is there any service in the UDDI registries which a lot of
Who
people...
Who uses UDDI?
No one uses UDDI. And basically, right. The idea of UDDI was not only to discover services, but also to have a repository of reusable services everyone could use. And I think there are legal problems, the services don't fit, there is no service standardization. So that can't possibly work. I don't believe in this.
One problem we have at this customer I'm working with currently is that there is this one department that when it asks for the data about a customer, it wants all the data that describes the customer, and it is acceptable to wait like a second or something. The other department, if they ask for a customer, they only need basic data, but they need it quickly because they're in the call center. So they can't even agree on, I mean, even if they could agree on what data is used to describe a customer, they couldn't agree which percentage of it should be returned when the service is asked for the data. So you have to describe variants of services, you know, like this one only returns a little bit of the patient data, the other one returns all the stuff, and that becomes really complex.
Yeah, and that's only two or three stakeholders involved, and think of about hundreds or even thousands of stakeholders which have to agree on all of these things, and that does not work.
Okay, so that's good. So we did some SOAR bashing. I think at some point we need somebody on the show who has a more positive view on this topic, so he can maybe defend SOAR. So anything else you want to say before we finish this episode?
Oh, my only last word. I really like service orientation, but as I said before, I don't like web services as a tool which is really applicable for everything. I think web services are very strong in integrating different middleware solutions on an enterprise level. And I think service orientation is an architectural paradigm with things like explicit interfaces, loose coupling, contracts, and all of the things which is really valuable. And you can use it with Corba or messaging middleware. So basically, don't try to combine both things into one pot. It's not only it's two different things. It's service orientation on one side, and on the other side it's web services, and both have really strengths and weaknesses.
And to add to that, I think, because I was bashing on SOAR a little bit, and I didn't want to say that SOAR is bad either, but the point is that many of the problems that we had in all these other paradigms, which is agreeing on interfaces, agreeing on data structures, dependency management, all that stuff, it's still a problem with SOAR. It doesn't go away, and people tend to forget that.
Absolutely. So basically, the problems remain the same, but the technologies and paradigms change.
Yeah. Okay, so then, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
This was another episode of Software Engineering Radio. The Software Engineering Radio team wants to thank Henning Pauli for providing the music, as well as Libsyn.com for hosting and bandwidth. For more information on the podcast, past episodes, and feedback, go to se-radio.net.